Hi, everybody. My name's Amy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
My home group is actually in Hume, Virginia. We meet on Wednesdays and Saturdays. You're all invited. And my sobriety date is December 21st, 1981. And my sponsor is Karen G., and she lives in Berkeley, California. I'm sober. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. I never thought I wanted to stay sober. And when I got here, I didn't really want to live either. But today, I want to do both. I want to continue to grow in this thing called sobriety, and I want to live. And to me, that's what it's all about. That's what all this thing is about, is really, really, really living. It's not about, you know, getting into a box and doing the right thing and being a good little girl. It's about really finding out what this is, what life is, and going for it, you know? I'll tell you a little bit what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But what it's like now is that I wake up in the morning and I am comfortable. I'm comfortable in my own skin. And the last thing that I think about, I don't think about taking a drink. I don't think about, I'm a child of the, I was born in 1961. I did drugs too. I'm sorry, that's just my experience. My experience, Strength and Hope, I did drugs. I did alcohol. Anything that would get me stoned, get me high, I did. It didn't matter. I didn't read the labels. I didn't count the pills. I didn't care what color they were. I just wanted to get high. I just wanted to get out of my skin. And I wake up in the morning and don't even think about that. You know what I do? I pray. That's the first thing I do. And this thing about, you know, my higher power, I love what you read. I should put my glasses on. Because it's that experience of this higher power and what that was for me. I was in a meeting in Alexandria recently, and this guy who was old, and he was kind of luminescent. You know how people start to radiate light when they're sober for a really long time? And this guy had that. And he raised his hand. He said, "I'm so-and-so, and my story is not unique." And then he went on to tell this amazing story, you know. That's not going to happen here. My story really is not unique. I was a teenage alcoholic. I stood outside of grocery stores and asked adults to buy me booze. They did. I mean, would you buy a 12-year-old some? But anyway, they did it. We forged notes from our parents saying, "My mom wants me to buy a case of beer. Will you buy it for me?" But she didn't. You know. Anyway, they believed it. So I drank from the get-go. It didn't even. You know, it was around my family. My grandpa was the town drunk. And so my dad and my mom were kind of, they really watched their drinking, you know. But it was always around. It wasn't like they stopped. But when we ran out of pop, we'd yell out, "Hey, Mom, can we have a beer?" And she'd yell down, "Just one." So she kind of, you know, so we'd split a beer. And, you know, that was when I was about 6 or 7. Getting high and getting drunk were just what you did. I had older brothers and sisters. I'm the youngest of 6. I grew up a Catholic. And it was, you know, that's what they did. That's what I did. We were just going to go get drunk, you know. And I was emulating my big brothers, and they were partiers. And so that was what I was, you know, that was a cool thing to do. So that's what I did. I remember, though, the thing that really escalated my use was my mom died when I was 12. And I didn't know, golly gee, I didn't know how to deal with the emotions. And my dad, so it was my dad and my two big brothers, everybody else had moved away. And I was this, you know, 12-year-old little girl. And my mom had died, and I remember I would come home from school, and I would run around the house going, hey, Mom, where are you? And then I'd get on my bicycle, and I'd ride my bike up to the cemetery, And I'd see that she was in the ground, and then I'd ride back home and have a beer, you know. and then Dad would come home, he was a construction worker, and his name was Bill, and her name was Margie, and he had tattoos right here, and he smoked Camel Buttless, they said he was a big partier. But he quit before I was born. But he was a time bomb. And, it's almost like he needed a drink, you know. He was like on this big dry drunk, and he was going to man it up, you know. He was tough. And so he was smoking and drinking coffee. And then when Mom died, it was like you could feel like the explosives around him. So, except I've always been a talker. I've always been kind of, you know, and not a little bit charming, like I could charm you to give me drugs and alcohol or money, or, you know, I just got away with murder. And so my dad, I could go in like somebody would break the lamp and they would push me in and I'd say, "Hey Dad, we broke the lamp." And I would not get in trouble. I could get away with it. Everybody else would get in trouble. So I that was cash for me. That was my currency, is get away with it. And so when I started using and drinking on a daily basis when I was 12, after my mom died, because I couldn't deal with the emotions. And I remember one time, this is recently, I was in the girls' restroom and I was Catholic school, you know, the plaid skirt, the little sweater, the little Peter Pan collar, right, you know, so I'm in there, and I had a hangover, right, so I was in the stall, and I was vomiting, and I'm walking out in my little plaid thing, you know, I'm not smoking at the time, and, you know, 12-year-old, I felt like I was 80, and I was 12 years old. Anyway, so I'm, you know, I'm smoking in the can, and Katie McDonald comes in, and we were very good friends in fourth grade. This is like seventh grade, and she's not cool. But I like her. But anyway, she comes up to me, and she's got her whole thing going on, you know, and I've got mine tied up at the waist, and she goes, "Amy, you smell like alcohol." And I go, "Yeah, I know, Katie. I needed a drink. Don't tell anybody." And she looks at me, and I could tell that there was something wrong with that. You know, like, there's something wrong here. We're 12 years old. We're in the John. I'm smoking. She's telling me I've got booze on my breath. And sister, you know, Margaret is down the road. So I remember just turning it off. I had this capacity where I could just, there was something that would come through like, "Aim, you shouldn't be doing this." And I would go, "Uh-huh." And I go do my thing. And that's basically the story, you know. I remember a little while later after that, it was Lent, you know, you're supposed to give up stuff, and they go in the church, they shroud everything in purple. It's very solemn, and one of my friends had bought a case of beer, and there was up at the public school up the road, there was a carnival, and so all those Catholic girls would go up to the public school and go on the carnival, and one of my friends had this case of beer, and I knew I wasn't supposed to do it, and I went into church. I was always seeking, like when I turned double digits when I was 10, I wrote my last will and testament. You know, I thought, okay, you know, I'm getting old here, I decided I would read the Bible, and I couldn't, all the begats, I couldn't understand it. And I remember going to First Holy Communion and going, you know, like, let's feel this, but I couldn't feel anything up at Holy Communion, you know, the thing that I felt gave me that relief was alcohol. You know, I would also, I remember eating mushrooms and going out and watching trees, and that was a little later. That was when I was like in you know, 16, 17. But that, to me, I read Carlos Castaneda and all those spiritual books, and I was like, "Yeah, man, this is like great peyote. Let's do it." You know, and that was for me. I thought, okay, I'm going to seek relief through drugs and alcohol. And I'll find God that way, if there is a God. And then after a while, I just didn't care. I just wanted relief. When I was 19, my dad died. And that he was he was like a staunch, upright guy, you know, and he was always in the other room, always in the other room. Sometimes we never spoke, we never talked, but there he was, and he was my sense of security. Even he, you know, I got arrested about 6 months before he died, check this out. So I live in Spokane, Washington. And I'm gonna go get drunk on the Idaho border. Because in Washington it's 21, it's 19 in Idaho back then, you know, right? But I had to drive, you know, so I go to Idaho, the state line, I'm high, I'm drunk, I'm wasted out of my mind. I see the police after me. I grab this bottle of perfume, I start drinking perfume to hide the right? Genius. Anyway, so I'm so sick by the time the cop comes up to me. Anyway, I get arrested. And this is embarrassing, but I'm in the back of the police car and I'm trying to hit on the cop so he won't call my dad. I'm saying, listen, I'll sleep with you, really. I'll sleep with you. Just don't call my dad. Thank God I got an honest cop, right? He put me in the jail. He called my dad. My dad came, and my dad walked in, and I saw his eyes, and I knew something was wrong, and I just turned it off. I just left. I still can't remember what happened, you know. But anyway, I do remember going to the court with my dad, and he's walking out. He always had, you know, I don't know if, construction workers, so he was a construction worker and he owned his own demolition company. And he always smelled like concrete and tobacco. And he rolled his sleeves up here and he had tattoos right here. Always had a cigarette sticking out of his mouth. And he had these big work boots and then he would roll up his cuffs and put his ashes in his cuffs, because he was constantly smoking, so he needed his traveling ashtray. So this was his thing. So he's walking out there, he's got an unlit camel hanging out of his mouth and I got off on the charges. I had to go to court counseling and do some service work on the roads in the Orange. I didn't have to do any time or anything, you know, go to jail or anything. And he lied to me for me. The judge said, "Sir, have you ever seen your daughter drunk?" And he'd seen me drunk a million times. And he said no, and he was so mad at me for making him lie, and he looked at me and he said, "I have never lied for anybody, and I will never lie for you again," and then he died, you know, and that threw me. It threw me into. There was no stops, you know. When I was in high school, I won a scholarship to study theater, and I went to school, and I drank so much that I got kicked out of school, and I also it's an honors program, and the things I did. I was 19 years old, and I was on tour with this show, and this older actor who was a part of the company I was with and who was married to a friend of mine was also on tour, and we got wasted one night and I slept with him, and you know, this guy, and I remember thinking, oh, his wife is my friend, and I just turned it off, you know, I just turned off that kind of conscience, and what happened is he freaked out, I guess. He tried to commit suicide, and his wife found out, and he tried to commit suicide. I came home. My dad was dead, and I was still living in the family home, but it was a big party house. You know, I would walk over people to get out the door, people I didn't even know, and this was the family home. So this guy comes over, and he tells me he called me from the hospital. And he said, "Listen, I tried to commit suicide," and I said, "Well, you can crash at my joint, but I'm not in the bargain. If you know, it's you're on your own." And I bought 5 grams of cocaine and drove to Montana, where I had some friends. And when I came back, he was gone. And then I got a call from the dean of the college, and she said, "We're asking you to leave the program." And I said, okay. And she said, we're trying to protect so-and-so, this guy. And I said, okay. And I said, from what? And she said, from you. And at that moment, you know, I was the charming one. I was the apple of my daddy's eye. I could talk anything off, you know. And at that moment, I knew that the gig was up. Somebody saw through me. And I felt like, you know, that part where they say, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. When I read that the first time, I knew that feeling. Because at that moment, when I was holding that phone, that it felt like my life was like this big domino game. And it was just going boom, boom, boom. And there was nothing I could do. And then I continued to drink after that, you know. And December 21st, 1981, my sister sends me some dough. And she lives in Front Royal. And says, come to visit for Christmas. And so I said, okay. And I think I'm gonna give away all my drugs and stuff. Because I knew drugs were wrong because they were illegal, you know. Booze, you're supposed to be able to drink. You're supposed to be able to drink, right? Drinking is normal. And so I thought, okay, I'll give away all my paraphernalia. I won't do any drugs. And maybe I'll have a drink on Christmas and maybe a couple drinks on New Year's, but I'm going to take this 2 weeks at my sister's. I'm going to figure out my life and then I'll come back and, you know, be an actor, take the world, you know. And so I remember praying right before that, and I was looking out and I remember that thing where my friend bought the case of beer and the carnival was up the street. I went into church and I said, God, I said, show me. Give me something. Give me a sign. Otherwise, I'm going to go up and drink this booze. And nothing happened. You know, the big purple shrouds, there was nothing going on. I'm like, I'm out. And so I went up and I went and got stoned, you know. And that was basically, otherwise it was all this alternative stuff. And, you know, but I couldn't really feel an experience of God. I felt shut off, isolated. I couldn't even really talk to other people because, like, if I started to talk about something serious, I'd get real shaky and nervous, and you know, I couldn't really let anybody in, and I couldn't really get out. So I just drank, and so December 21st, 1981. About 2 days before that, I'm praying, and out the window, I see these two pipes on the house next door, and it's like a cross, you know. And I remember sincerely asking for help. Just please help me. And prayers are answered, you know. Anyway, so I get on this plane. I'm late. I'm late. It's overbooked. They give me $200 for my inconvenience. I go to another flight, you know, because it's Christmas and this whole thing. So they put me on. I was supposed to go to Denver and then to Dulles, and they put me on a flight from Spokane to San Francisco. I get on a flight in San Francisco. I fly to L.A. I'm pulling out of San Francisco, right? And I've got $200 for my inconvenience. And so I'm pulling out of San Francisco, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, San Francisco is a beautiful town, and, right? And so I'm pulling out, and I'm going, that's so pretty, all these lights, it was dark, you know. And then I just happened to look up, and it was the clearest night, and the stars were amazing. And again, I had a thought about God, and it was just a simple, maybe a little bit of humility. And you know, that I was putting God first, and I just said, wow, you put us to shame. You know, the stars of heaven put the stars of San Francisco, just diminished it. And so again, there was this softness, you know. Plus I was hung over a little bit, and I was vulnerable, you know. So that's the best time to get an alcoholic, you know, when there's not feeling that great about the whole thing. So I'm in LA, and in San Francisco, this is very interesting, I think. In San Francisco, they put me next to a guy who's a born-again Christian. And he starts to save me, right? And I'm like, I'm not interested, man. I know all about that Christ stuff. I'm not interested. So in L.A., I get sat next to a guy coming back from Japan. And I'm in first class. They put me in first class at this time, you know what? So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, okay, this is pretty cool, first class. It's good. And this guy comes up, and he's from Rhode Island. He's got a funny accent. You know, I'm from Spokane. We talk normally. And and the people, and so this guy goes, so who are you? And he's got this Abraham Lincoln beard on, which was very weird at the time. People, only Abraham Lincoln could wear that beard, you know? But now it's kind of hip and cool. But back then, so he has this Abraham Lincoln beard, and he's got a digital watch, which was also highly suspect. You know, analog was the thing. So he's got this digital watch, this Abraham Lincoln beard. He's got a three-piece suit on and camel hair coat, and he's styling, right? I am in Levi's. I've got desert boots and an antique lace shirt that's kind of beat up and ripped, and my hair is when bi-level haircuts were in, so half of it's up high, half of it's down low. Anyway, so, you know, here we are, sitting next to each other. And he comes in and says, well, who are you? I was also a big liar at the time. And so I had a captive audience. He asked me who I am. I'm going to lie, right? I'm going to tell him everything. Because if I can make you believe I was somebody different, then I could believe I was somebody different for just a tiny little bit, right? So I'm lying. I would tell a little bit of the truth, like I'm an heiress. I'm an orphan. You know, because my dad left me. I guess he left. He was a hard worker. We each, all six kids, got about $90,000. I had that last year went through $50,000 in on drugs and alcohol and stupid shit. You know, it was just stupid stuff. And so I was an heiress and I was an orphan. So he sat next to me. He was coming back from Japan, and we were both in first class. And so he says, and I told him about being rerouted, you know, and being given $200 for my inconvenience. And he says, so are you going to go paint the town red? And I said, well, I don't drink. And kind of looks at me and goes, well, you don't need to drink to paint the town red. And I said, well, I don't do drugs either. And he kind of looks at me. And then he starts to tell me this story about how he's been sober for 5 years. And his last drink was on NyQuil. And then he said, you know, I can't get over the fact that somebody went to a lot of trouble to get you and I to meet. And all the hairs stood up on my neck, and I knew he had capitalized the somebody. And I've never wanted to have a drink since. That was a moment when I had, you know, notions about God, but that was the moment where I felt like there was a power that believed in me. Not, you know, that there was something that had a vested interest in my life. And then, he 13-stepped me. It's an honest program. I don't recommend that. It's not, you know, but that's what happened. And I'm not sure if I would have been, you know, I was who I was. I'm not sure if I would have really heard the message had it not come with this dandy messenger. But it lasted about 3 weeks, you know, which was long. It was a long relationship for the time. But you know, I remember getting off the plane, and my sister had come to get me, and she, it's my new friend. And she's like, what? And because I'm 20, right? I'm 20. He's like 50. He's my age, right? And she's like, her steam is just blown. She's 30. And but he comes down from, he lives in Vienna. He comes down to Front Royal, gets me, goes, takes me to meetings. I'm learning. He's also given me the books. I'm doing reading assignments. He's saying, read the third step. And I'm reading and I'm doing all this stuff. And then I take initiative and I start to go to meetings in Front Royal. And I did grab a hold of this program as the Drowning Seas Life Preservers. He said, why don't you stay with your sister for 90 days, and, you know, we'll gladly refund your misery if you're not happier in 90 days. Try it out. Just let's go for it. And so I did. I did. I went for it. I threw myself into the program. I couldn't believe that I was being given a second chance. And it made sense to me. Do I need powder? Where's makeup? It made sense to me that I had a disease, you know. I had my grandpa who was the town drunk. My dad was definitely on a dry drunk. That made sense to me. My other grandpa, I remember smelling because I was the littlest kid. When grandpa came to visit, I had to sleep on the couch and he got my bedroom, but I had to go in there and get clothes. And I remember the whole room would just smell of alcohol, right? So I knew it ran in my family. My brother had been arrested. My dad always said, you got the same thing your brother has. And so I knew about, I'd also seen that Linda Blair movie. Do you remember the Linda Blair movie in the 70s? She was an alcoholic. And she came up there, and so I was like, oh, there's something going on here. So when you all told me it was a disease, a physical allergy, coupled with an obsession of the mind that could only be relieved spiritually, that made sense. I'm like, okay, I've got a disease. It's an allergy. I know what that is. I know that when I drink, I cannot tell what I will be ingesting. That was my experience. In fact, but I didn't really want to stop, you know, drinking. That was the relief to the pain. That was the relief to the pain. And so I knew I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. To me, if I just stay in that first step, like, let's drink. You know, that right there is a description of hell. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Right there is pain. It's being so uncomfortable in your own skin. It's not being able to communicate with another human being. It's not feeling like for me, I thought it was a huge mistake. I sometimes, when I did not have a drink in me, I would feel like a leper, like there was something gross about me, like something like dirty about me. That was me without a drink. So I meet these guys. I met, you know, this guy who introduced me to the program. And then I remember going to my first meeting all by myself. It was in Front Royal. And I went to the wrong door, you know, of course, this is my first time all by myself. I went into the wrong door and everybody, it was Christmas and they were having bell practice. I thought, oh shit, I cannot join this AA thing. Anyway, they told me that the AA meeting was across the hall, right? So I went to the AA meeting. But I remember walking in, and I was smoking, because you could smoke at meetings back then. And if I'd got the, you know, Levi's and this beat up music. And I've got the whole thing, like, I'm tough. I'm a tough person here. I'm smoking, and I walk in, and all these, there was this guy named Jim H., and his wife, and this other guy named Garth, and another guy named Bill, who had 4 months, and another woman named Mary, and they were all, probably the youngest one was 60. And I walk in, I say, "Is this AA meeting?" And they go, "Yep." And they ask me questions about me, and they didn't say we drank more than we spilled more than you drank. They didn't say you can't be here because you did drugs. They didn't say any of that. They just said, "Hey, honey, it looks like you got what we got." And then they let me stay, and they introduced me to this program and told me they gave me the keys to the kingdom. That's this thing. This thing is the keys to the kingdom in my book. To come to believe in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. That sanity thing. I felt insane. I felt the mental obsession. It was clear to me. I thought it possible that there is a power. I just didn't know how to access it. You know, I didn't know how to access it. And what you all told me was that this was the way to access it. And that God works through human beings. And You know, that's the amazing thing, is I started to feel the presence of this power greater than myself. I started to feel it at AA meetings, and it started to soften the armor, and it started to you know, my heart started to come out, and I started to trust life and trust this experience. And that to make a decision, you know, I think, well, what are the options here? You know, really, making a decision to turn our will and our like okay, you go out there and feel insane and crazy and never have your dreams come true and end up in the gutter, or go to AA. I mean, really? Okay. You know, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood Him. And I think that thing, God as we understood Him, that we each get to find our own concept of God. If there's ever a time, capsule that gets put into the ground from the 20th century, that thing goes in. This is the only thing that's ever happened on planet Earth where we agree to disagree about God. I mean, that's phenomenal. And that I got to discover an experience of, and get to continue to discover an experience of a God that I understand, it's a tremendous freedom. It's what my life is built on, really. I mean, right? And this book is so simple, and it outlines this program of recovery. And so I followed. I couldn't find a sponsor right away, so I just read the directions. It took me about 2 weeks to get sober enough so that I could read. That was one of the things that really broke my heart. I couldn't focus on the words anymore when I was using at the end of my drinking. And then to be able to read again was such a gift. And so I read everything, and I became obsessed with, oh, I love this. It turned to page 100, which is my favorite paragraph in the... I'll read it later. This, just to follow the rules, you know, it's all set out. I resent. I'm resentful at God because my dad died. I'm resentful at God because my mom died. I'm resentful at them for kicking me out. I'm resentful at myself. A lot of my stuff was aimed at me. I hated myself. I was at war with myself. And I wanted to die. I remember driving and praying that I would or I wouldn't turn my wheels under an oncoming semi. You know, that was at the end, that was my train of thought. But to write it all down and put it all, and I remember I still have my first fourth step, and my writing, a 20-year-old's writing, it's like it was just so innocent. I was really like, okay, I'm gonna do this thing, and I just followed the directions, and then I was at that meeting where that same person was, and where those older people were, and this blonde bombshell comes in. She's 35 and she's an airline stewardess. And her name's Eva Marie McGee. And I'm like, that's her, my sponsor. and so she showed up, and she told me, we glommed on to each other, and she was having a little tryst down in Front Royal with a guy. She was living in Alexandria, and she was having a relationship with this guy out in Front Royal. And so that's how we met. And then at 3 months sober, I flew back to Spokane because I thought, okay, I'm gonna stick with this. And she had introduced me to all the steps by then. We'd worked through them, and she said, Amy, this is a tool belt. It's like you've got these tools that will help you for the rest of your life. And maybe you'll grab a screwdriver to pound in a nail. Maybe, you might do that at first, but you'll learn how to work this. So I had worked, by 3 months, I had worked through all the steps, and I shared them with her. And for me, I'm so glad I didn't run into anybody at that point who said, oh, take your time. Work a step a year. I don't know, because the pain was so acute. And for me, the relief to the pain is in the steps. I was at a meeting recently, and this guy who's been in and out and in and out and in and out, and this guy is one of the sweetest men you've ever ever sat next to at an AA meeting. You know, we all know him. Just got this great face and his sweet heart, and he keeps going out. You know, he keeps going out. And so he sat next to me, and I said, we were talking a little bit, and I go, do you mind if I ask you a question? And he goes, no, what? And I go, well, what makes you go out? And he just looked at me in his clear eyes, and he said, pain. Right? And isn't it crazy? Pain is the touchstone of spiritual progress. Pain is the thing that drove us into the ground with drinking and alcohol, and pain is the thing that liberates us. Pain is the opportunity for me to find freedom. It's so crazy that pain is that, you know, it's wow, I can either use it to go to God or I can use it to go to hell. You know, either way. And it just blew my mind, you know, that he had, it just like, it just focused it for me. And that, you know, when I got sober, I haven't wanted to take a drink since I got here. And that's a miracle. It's a miracle. I haven't wanted to take a drug either. One time I did, I was running. I'm a runner in other ways too, but I was running and I ran through this car, and this guy, at the same time I ran by his window, blew out a big of marijuana smoke, and I was like flying, and I was like, wow, what's that? And I hit ground and I just kept running. You know, I didn't. It was like, okay, I'm not going there. And you know, there was a time when I would have backed up and said, "Hey man, you want to share a little bit of that?" And you know, it didn't even hit me. I have had that psychic change, and that is the grace of God. You know, however, I had that pain. You know, there were times. I mean, I just a few instances. I had about 6 years of sobriety, and I was living in Seattle, Washington. I'd become an actor again, graduated at the top of my class. This guy who gave me my diploma was also in the program. He handed me my diploma, and it was like God saying, "It is, you know, like you wouldn't get this if you were sober, you know." And so anyway, I was in a show, and I quit smoking. Because it was a very active show, it was kind of an athletic thing, and so I had to take care of my lungs. So I was at home that night, and I passed in front of a mirror, and I saw myself, and it was like a crack in my mind, and I lost track of time and space, and I woke up, and I don't know how long it was. I don't think it was any longer than about 30 minutes, maybe 10. I'm not sure. But I had scratches all over my body and a big welt where I think I probably hit my head against the porcelain tub. And I beat myself up. And I thought, I was like, oh fuck! And I went over and I bought some. Excuse my French. And I went over and I bought some cigarettes and smoked about 3 cigarettes. Tried to call my sponsor because it was on his payphone. And I walked in the house and I thought, shit, you know, I'm crazy. I'm a nut. I thought I just had alcoholism, but I'm cuckoo. And I was scared. I was really, really scared. And the phone was ringing. I pick up this phone, and this friend who was an alcoholic. I always say about her, it's like she was born with a program. You know, she was just one of those nice people who are born with a program. Anyway, and she goes, "Hey, how are you doing?" And I said, "I'm not doing too well." And she asked me what was going on, and she said, "I'll be right over." And she went. And now, until this moment, what I do with AA meetings, I go through stuff, and then I go to AA, and I tell you about it, but I would never cry in front of you. I would never really open up. I would just report that I had cried, you know? I wouldn't really let you in. And this is the first time she ran in, and she sat down, and she held me while I cried. And I think I was crying for my dad's death and my mom's death and being born and then she recommended that I see her psychoanalyst. So I had this little thing of 12 and 12, and I took this thing and I said, these are the principles that I live by. Are you down with that? And she goes, oh yes, I'm familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I would go to therapy, and then I would go to my sponsor, and I'd say, this is what we talked about. And then she would reinterpret the language. We would reinterpret the language of therapy into a spiritual language. Like in therapy, I heard a lot about confronting, where here we talk about amends, you know, and taking responsibility. So, and the way I felt like in therapy was like it was like 4 and 5. You know, it was a really good inventory. We really got down to causes and effects and ins and outs of my emotions and all that stuff. But it couldn't take me into transformation. I couldn't get free with just therapy. That was my experience. What I got was a lot of self-information. But what happened was after I went through therapy, and then I became entirely ready to have God remove these character defects, and the biggest one was self-hate. The biggest one was self-hate and resistance to life, you know. So I went through that, and at about 10 years sober, I remember I was running trails. You know, Seattle is very hilly, and I was running these trails, and it was like I was flying. And I remember thinking, I'm free. And I'd stopped smoking for a year, and I felt comfortable in my own skin, and I felt that sense of well-being, and that was a big turning point for me. That was a really big turning point. But again, that pain that is the touchstone of spiritual progress. I think in the ninth tradition it says, great suffering and great love are AA's two disciplinarians. We need no others. Something like that. And that for me, it's that great suffering of my ism takes me into a deeper experience of a great love, which for me is an experience of God. And so over and over again, I've being sober and having this experience of, because the ism for me is still there. It's that sense of I get to a place in my life, like, for example, so I remember, can I finish it all in 10 minutes? Yes. I remember getting to a place, I was in Seattle, and I was on the phone with my sister, and I said, Mary, I'm just not the kind of girl you take home to meet your mother, and because I had the ism with men, you know, with relationships. I remember, and part of that is what I was 20. You know, I was 27 years old, 28 years old, and a 28-year-old girl is going to do what a 28-year-old girl does, and plus I was in the arts. You know, I was. Wacky, you know, I was free, I was a wild bird. And so, and what was good about my friend Eva Marie McGee, that my sponsor, we were driving up to, when I was first sober, we were driving up to Washington, D.C. to go to a meeting up there, and I missed my turn. And she, who's my big sponsor with 5 years sober, wanted me to take the authorized vehicle thing and make a U-turn. And I said, we can't do that, because I'm sober now. I have to do everything right. I'm perfect, right? And she goes, would you do it if you were drunk? She denies this, by the way. She says, would you do it if you were drunk? I said, well, shit, yes, of course I'd do it if I was drunk. She goes, do it, because she knew that if we got her on the book beltway, we'd never get around. So I said, okay, I will. And so we did it. But the thing is that really taught me that I didn't get sober to live the life of a sober judge. That I got to be free. I got to have fun. I got to make mistakes, you know. I was 20 years old. It's for me, it's not about being it's not about dying. It's about living. And sometimes life is wild, and at least it is in me. And You know? And that's like, you never barred the doors to me. And thank you, thank you, thank you. Because I am a little odd. I got it. But I really appreciate you welcoming me, you know? Anyway, so I'm on the phone with Mary Kay. I'm not the kind of girl you take home to meet your mother. Right? So I do the steps. I do an inventory on all the men. I've never really done that. So I'm writing, I'm writing, I'm writing. I'm cleaning house, I'm cleaning house. 6 months later, I'm traveling across country with a guy who lives in New Jersey who's driving me to take home to meet his mother. Isn't that great? I mean, this is such an amazing program. And this thing about to practice these principles in all our affairs, I mean, that's it for me. Because over and over, I've got affairs. I've got stuff going on. I'm one of those people who seems to be there's stuff. And so I need a program. I need a program. I need to practice these principles in all my affairs. And over and over and over, I come up against something that I can't deal with. And I go, okay, I'm powerless. My life is unmanageable. This feels unmanageable again. Is there a God bigger than me that can take me into some form of sanity? Sanity for me means wholeness, feeling a part of, feeling one. So if I start to feel separate, I'm going into insanity. If I start to feel a part of, I'm going towards sanity. Does that make sense? So for me, so I come up and I go, can God help me here? Then I turn my will, which is all my drives and desires and my aspirations and my appetites and all that stuff. I turn it over to God. I turn my life, which is all the outcomes, over to God. And I clean house if I need to. I call my sponsor. I tell him what I found out. Tell her what I found out. She helps me look at it. I'm entirely ready to have God remove whatever blocks there are. I humbly ask, please, dear God. See, that's the thing, too. I always thought, I'm supposed to remove these defects of character. So I would work really hard. I can't. I can't do it. For me, it's about the proper use of the will, which is an alignment with God. It happens in the 11th step, right? I can feel the presence of spirit within me, which is just the life presence in my breath. And I lean into that. And then, out of the blue, amazing things happen over and over and over and over again. My life is an amazing thing. I'm back here in Front Royal because I'm living in Virginia because, there's so much. I've had this great life in this last 30-some years, you know. I've had an amazing life because I'm sober. I've traveled to Europe. I got married. I got divorced. I was in movies. I quit acting. I went back to school. I did all this cool shit, you know, all this great stuff, all sober. It's amazing stuff. And 2010, my sister told me she had a 30% chance to live in 5 years. She's got heart failure. And I thought, okay, God gave me these five brothers and sisters and I'm going to show up. I'm a runner. I ran, you know, away from love because I know you're going to die. You know, that's my mom and dad died. Everybody I meet, I still know that. First thing I think about, this guy's temporary. This person is going to die. And I can feel it. And today, that for me, it's like, okay, appreciate them while they're here. Love them while they're here. Cherish those eyes. Cherish that heart. Talk about everything you can to them. Share their dreams. You know, show up for them. So I'm showing up for my sister. And that's kind of hard. You know, it's scary because she can walk from here to there and she's out of wind. You know, I lived in her basement for a year when I first got sober. You know, she saved my life. But I keep showing up and I can love. I'm not scared. I'm not scared to love. I'm not scared to let her love me, and I'm not scared that she's gonna die. I'm not. I think it's part of it, right? This is my favorite paragraph in the whole big book, and it just opened up coincidentally, right? Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. That happens if you got a day, or a year, or 30 years. No matter what your present circumstances, follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thank you for my world.